vast majority of the world's non-Americans don't hate us for who we are, but they are very disturbed about some of the things that we have done. They want us to stop going around the world using or threatening the use of force. They want us to stop preaching to them and start listening to them.
Good morning and welcome to the Miller Center Forum. I asked our guest this morning, as I always do, how do you pronounce your name? Because I want to get it right. And she said, I swallow the last syllable in a very understated English sort of way. So, Helena Cobham. Helena Cobham is a widely published journalist and author. She was born in England and earned the BA and MA degrees from Oxford University. She is fluent in both Arabic and French and spent 5 years in Beirut as a correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor and the Sunday Times of London. Since 1982, she's lived in the United States but traveled regularly to the Middle East, Europe, Asia, and Africa. Helena Cobham's reporting has appeared in the major newspapers, journals, and blogs of the world, including The New York Times, The Economist, and Salon.com. The author of 6 books, including 4 on Middle East issues, 1 on post-conflict policies in Africa, and 1 on the role of moral leadership in building world peace. Her most recent book is Reengage: America and the World After Bush. She may be one of 2 Quakers who is a member of the London-based International Institute of Strategic Studies. When I learned that, I thought, well, perhaps out of antitheses comes synthesis. Please welcome Helena Cobham.
I want to thank George Gillam for inviting me and the Miller Center for hosting this great forum, which is really a wonderful way for people around the country, not just here in Charlottesville, to learn a lot about all kinds of things, but especially international affairs. And I think you all do a wonderful job here. And thanks to the AV people up there who webcast it, and thanks to all of you who came from around the region to participate in this discussion, and to everybody who's watching it elsewhere. I'm going to start with a couple of stories, because I've been really blessed to be able to travel so much in my work as a writer. I've gone to numerous countries around the world, some 18 or so just since 9/11. I was counting that up and trying to figure out what kind of a perspective that helps me to have. So the first of my little stories comes from Arusha, Tanzania. It was in April 2003, just at the beginning of April 2003, when the hostilities in Iraq were still underway. And I was walking along a little dirt lane back street in the city of Arusha, and I met a little girl who was skipping towards me. We were the only 2 on the whole street, and she was skipping off to school. And she stopped and she said, hello. I said, hello. She said, where are you from? I said, from America. She'd skipped by me by then. She stopped and she turned around and she said, why you bomb Iraq? And it struck me how sad it was that the first and perhaps the only thing this little girl knew about our country was that we were bombing Iraq. Second story comes from when I was a teenager in England in the 1960s. I got my first strong interest in international affairs working on the whole apartheid question that was much bigger then at that time than it was in this country. You know, I never believed that Nelson Mandela would ever get out of jail alive. I became a US citizen in 1987, and the South Africa issue became a big issue here in the United States around about that time. I still didn't believe that Nelson Mandela would ever get out of jail alive. I used to go around Washington, D.C. with a little pin saying, Free Nelson Mandela. And it started up a lot of conversations. But although I had the pin, I still didn't really believe, if you see what I mean. And then 3 years later, Amazingly, he walked out of the prison, and I don't know how many of you remember that day, but it was transformational for the whole of that country and for many of us around the world who cared about that issue so deeply. In recent years, I made two research visits to South Africa. I interviewed white South Africans and black South Africans about their experience of that transformation. And what really struck me was that the transformation was not just in structures in the country there, but also in attitudes. I talked with a young guy called Fanny Du Toit, who is a young Afrikaner who, as a student, had been a member of something called the Junior Brother Bond, which is sort of like the Junior Ku Klux Klan back in the apartheid days. He told me that even there, inside the Junior Brother Bond, he had witnessed signs of real change of attitudes. And now, Fanny Du Toit himself is a leader in the movement for social and racial reconciliation in South Africa. I realize I'm blessed to have been able to travel around the world so much in my career, and to have had thousands of invaluable conversations with members of the group that I call the other 6 billion. That is, our 6 billion fellow members of the human race who happen not to be Americans. My book is fundamentally about the kind of relationship that we as Americans want to build with the other 6 billion. We could call them the other 95%, since we make up only 5% of humanity. You see, I've studied, looked at, researched, and even to a little extent participated in foreign affairs for 35 years now, working mainly as a writer. And I've done formal strategic studies, and I've wrestled with complex issues of arms control, deterrence, counterterrorism, and so on. But at the end of the day, all of foreign affairs and all of strategic affairs really just comes down to relationships. What makes for a healthy relationship? What makes for an unhealthy relationship? How you can build healthy relationships of mutual respect with people even if they're very different from you, and how you can turn unhealthy relationships into better ones. I think that now, in 2008, our country's relationship with the rest of the world is badly damaged and is in dire need of healing. Those are practically the exact opening words of the first chapter of my book, and the whole of the rest of the book takes off from there. One important thing to understand is that because of our country's weight in the world, the decisions we Americans make at many different points in our lives, and not only at the ballot box, have a huge impact on people all around the globe, whether we realize that or not, and whether we intend it to happen or not. This is now clearer than ever in two key areas: agricultural subsidies and climate change. If we look at agricultural subsidies, one clear example is that the President and Congress recently decided to start giving huge subsidies to the biofuels industry in this country, and suddenly that has taken large chunks of our land out of grain production and helped push the steep rise in global grain prices. That is a huge current driver of political instability and raw human suffering in low-income countries around the world. It's devastating for people from Haiti to Egypt to India to most of the countries of sub-Saharan Africa. And all of that just so that we can get a few cents off the price of the fuel for our SUVs. Subsidies in other agricultural sectors have been harmful too. For example, when I was in Mozambique, a very low-income country indeed, I heard from development experts there how just about the whole of the country's once thriving cotton industry had been completely wiped out because of the quite unfair subsidies that our government gives to the producers of big cotton in this country, which enable American producers to undercut millions of producers from low-income countries around the world. In Mozambique, I found that thousands of cotton farmers had lost their livelihoods because of this. And this was at a time when the IMF was also forcing the country to dismantle its social service nets. Then if we look, for example, at climate change, zoning decisions made by towns and countries throughout this nation of ours have led to a lifestyle in which a large proportion of the population is quite car dependent. And what's more, as the planners here in the Thomas Jefferson Planning District and around the country understand, trying to provide decent transit services to these widely scattered populations is very expensive indeed. All this car dependency helps keep our nation's per capita carbon emissions incredibly high, twice as high per capita as those in Japan or the European Union. And since the whole atmosphere of the world is one atmosphere, what we puff out from our SUVs and other cars are harming other people around the world disproportionately more than theirs are harming us. So sitting here in the US, we might not understand how decisions taken completely in the context of our own domestic politics in areas like agricultural subsidies or zoning regulations might have any effect at all on the other people around the world. But because of our country's weight in world affairs and in the world economy, they certainly do. And all too often, that effect can be very harmful for the non-Americans concerned. Well, that's just some examples of how actions that we take at the domestic level have an effect on others around the world. And then, of course, there are the actions we take that we know are in the international sphere. Actions, for example, on the big international issues of war, peace, and sanctions. These have a clear impact on the peoples and communities most directly involved. But they also have a huge impact on the whole balance within the world, on the integrity of the international system as we have helped to build it up through the United Nations and all the other international multilateral organizations. I remember very clearly how I experienced the events of 9/11. It was a Tuesday. I was here in Charlottesville, in my home on Alderman Road, checking my email, when the news box that they had on the AOL interface in those days showed a horrifying photo of one of the World Trade Towers in flames. I turned on the big TV and watched horrified as the second plane flew into the second tower, and then, one after the other, each of the towers crumbled to the ground. Soon after, my editor at the Christian Science Monitor called me and asked if I could send her a column reflecting on the attack for Thursday's paper. I had precisely 4 hours to get the final text to her. I'm still pretty proud of what I wrote that day amidst so much continuing uncertainty and to my editor's very tight deadline. I wrote, "We may not know for many days yet how high the human casualties of Tuesday's attacks will mount, but we should take care that some of our country's basic values don't fall casualty to the attacks too." I'm afraid that has happened too much. I'm afraid that since 9/11, our country has veered too far away from its long-standing commitments to fairness in international relations, to the norms of the United Nations and the Geneva Conventions, and above all, to the two basic ideas of the United Nations, that warfare should only be an option of the very last resort after all other means have quite evidently failed, and should only be undertaken with the full approval of the United Nations. And secondly, that all the world's people are worthy of equal respect and regard. We have to face the fact that the so-called global war on terror that the Bush administration launched after 9/11 simply hasn't worked. In 2001, the worldwide fatalities from international terrorism were already unacceptably high, at a level of 5,260 casualties, that's fatalities. That included the 2,900 from the incidents in this country, the Twin Towers and the Pentagon and the deaths in Pennsylvania, 5,260 worldwide. But every year from 2003 on, that was the year that President Bush decided to invade Iraq, The numbers of fatalities from international terrorism worldwide, as tallied by our own government's State Department, have risen steeply above that 2001 number. Last year, in 2007, it was 4.3 times as high as it was in 2001. My book, Reengage: America and the World After Bush, has five substantive chapters that look at different aspects of our country's relationship with the rest of the world. One of these is precisely on the traditional kind of security issues, specifically the challenges we face from terrorism and from the possible proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. One is on international economics, one on human rights, one on climate change, and one on the whole big shift that is already underway in the balance among the world's nations. You know, back in the 1990s, President Clinton and Secretary of State Albright liked to talk a lot about the US being the indispensable nation. The well-informed German analyst of international affairs, Joseph Joffe, who's a graduate of Swarthmore College, like to say that the role the US played in the world in that decade was that of an uber power. But things have changed a lot since the 1990s. Back then, the US stood astride the world in military power, in economics, in the wealth and strength of our human resources, and in reputational power, or what's called soft power. But now, we retain our clear number one spot only in terms of military power. In all those other three important dimensions of national power, we have fallen far, sometimes very far, from our earlier perch as number one. And this at a time when, thanks in large part to the spread of the new information technologies, military power on its own has become just about incapable of holding for any nation strategic goals of any worth that lie inside other nations' lands. In other words, military power may still be good for self-defense, but if you want to go out and do regime change in Iraq or Lebanon or other countries, military power on its own is not going to do that for you. It's not like the old days of the 19th century, when the British or the French or the Germans or the Belgians could go to sub-Saharan Africa and just seize whole chunks of it and wipe out the local people and nobody back home would ever learn about it. Soft power and economic power have become much more important than they used to be. And President Bush, sadly, has squandered our country's assets in both those important dimensions. I have to say, however, that Reengage is not a partisan book. I go out of my way to note, for example, that some things some Republican governors have done in the field of pro-green energy policy, including Governor George Bush himself back in the day in Texas, were pretty good and pretty helpful. We could think of Governor Schwarzenegger in California today. I sincerely believe that the ideas and suggestions I make in my book could be adopted by either a Democratic or a Republican president. And there are certainly some Republicans, like Senator Chuck Hagel, who have what I think of as a very clear view of what America's role in the world should be. And I worry that some Democrats in Congress or even the presidency might stick too much to old ways of thinking, including in a desire to prove their capabilities as military leaders. But Reengage is also different from most books that are published by foreign policy specialists, and probably from most books that are featured here at the Miller Center. It is not a book that is primarily for people who are already foreign policy specialists. I wrote it, in the first instance, for Jane and Jose, US citizen, for American citizens who are concerned that there is something out of kilter in our country's relationship with the rest of the world, but don't necessarily have all the facts at hand and don't necessarily have the confidence to engage in the big national discussions on these issues. Discussions that, anyway, are dominated far too much by professional talking heads or we could call them professional screeching heads, who dominate the discussions with sound bites that are too often just mindlessly jingoistic. In fact, the subtitle on the book is, it's rather small print, An Informed Citizen's Guide. And if this book works out well, why, maybe we'll produce some more along the way, but this one has been a lot of work. Jane and Jose Citizen, I believe, already have most of the smarts they need to understand international affairs and to play a constructive part in changing our country's course to something like the one that I advocate in the book, which I call a policy of global inclusion. So what I've tried to do with the book is give Jane and Jose some of the basic tools they might need as they discuss these issues with their neighbors, with their congressional representatives, in the course of the important national debate that we're going to be having over the months ahead. In the book, I've provided lots of basic data that illustrate different aspects of our country's relationship with and impact on the rest of the world. Much of it is in the form of charts, and I'm kind of proud of my work making the charts. I introduce some handy terms. One is global inclusion, which I spell out quite a lot in the book. Another is human security, which is a way of understanding security that is a whole lot more holistic and realistic than just counting warheads or regiments. And in the book, I tell a few stories. Here's one that I didn't tell there. It's about a man called Albie Sachs, who's a white Jewish South African who sits on that country's Supreme Court. Albie is a sweet and very wise guy whom I had the honor of interviewing in his home in Cape Town back in 2003. But 15 years earlier, Albie was an outlaw. He was wanted by the South African police for his affiliation with the ANC, an organization that had an armed wing that was attacking various kinds of installations throughout the country. Albie had fled into exile in neighboring Mozambique, and one day he was returning from a walk on the beach there when South African secret agents tried to kill him with a bomb. But the bomb succeeded only in severing his right arm, and he survived, luckily. That was a time when Margaret Thatcher and many other Western leaders were still labeling the ANC as terrorists. And the ANC did have, as I said, a wing that carried out violent activities inside South Africa. But 2 years after the South African secret police bombed Albie Sachs, the white government of South Africa found a way to start talking to the ANC, and thank God they did. The walls of apartheid came tumbling down. South Africa's long-excluded majority population finally got the vote. The ANC won the elections. White South Africans were not persecuted for their past sins, and Albie Sachs's considerable talents and wisdom were brought onto the country's Supreme Court. Deep transformations of the relationships among people, like the one that I saw in South Africa, certainly are possible. We, as Americans, could certainly bring one about in our relationship with the rest of the world if we chose. And here's a little secret that I reveal in the book. The rest of the world is very eager for this transformation to happen. The vast majority of the world's non-Americans don't hate us for who we are, but they are very disturbed about some of the things that we have done. They want us to stop doing those bad things. They want us to stop going around the world using or threatening the use of force on a unilateral basis, unsanctioned by the United Nations. They want us to stop subsidizing the use of agricultural land to produce motor fuel that we need only in order to power our oversized SUVs. They want us to stop pumping out quite disproportionate amounts of carbon dioxide emissions into the air. They want us to stop preaching to them and start listening to them. They want us, quite simply, to treat them as equals, as fellow humans who are worthy of just as much respect in God's world as Americans are. So finally, I just really hope you like the book. I hope you find it helps you connect with some of the concerns of the other 6 billion people around the world. I'd like quickly to commend my publishers at Paradigm Press in Boulder, Colorado, who did a great job in getting this innovative little book out, excellently produced and with a very fast turnaround time. I want to thank Congressman Lee Hamilton and the other people who provided just wonderful endorsements that you can read on the back of the book. As you'll see, Paradigm has published the book as a paperback from the get-go. It costs just $14.95. I guess the guy who's selling them outside is also taking tax, so $15.70 here. In fact, I've heard from friends and from my own 23-year-old daughter that the young people also thinks it makes a great read, so you might want to pick up a couple of copies for graduation presents while you're about it. If anyone wants more information about the book before buying it, why, go to the website, which is www.reengage.net. That's reengage with a hyphen in the middle. I think we'll have some great opportunities over the months ahead to discuss America's relationship with the rest of the world in a whole new way. I want this book to contribute to that broad national discussion. Tell all your friends about it. But first of all, I'm looking forward to an excellent discussion here. Thank you.
I'm going to invite those who have questions to move to the back of the room, and we will take as many questions as we have time for. Let me open the discussion by recognizing in your book, you point out the importance, as you say, of strengthening state institutions in deeply stressed and vulnerable countries. You don't, however, go into great detail as to how the next president ought to decide which state institutions in deeply stressed and vulnerable countries we should try to strengthen. Don't we risk going back to where we were some years ago when we were propping up dictators and undesirables? What should be the screen? What should be the litmus test in American foreign policy for who we assist and who we just as soon see go?
That's a great question. I think the first part of the answer would be that it really isn't something that Americans need to decide all on their own. I think this is one of the aspects of the paradigm shift I'm talking about. You know, Americans love to have this kind of heroic self-image that when there's a cyclone in Myanmar or Burma, that, you know, Americans should go and give the aid. But actually, other people are also very capable of giving aid, and they are giving aid. There are currently some problems with the US military going in because there's a long-standing political conflict between Burma and the current Burmese government and the United States. So in regard to George's question as well, you know, when you're looking at which state institutions in which countries around the world you need to prop up, first of all, I'd say it's not primarily an American decision. It's something that the United States, in concert with other countries and certainly with the United Nations, which does a lot more in terms of very solid economic and social development aid around the world, they have real experts who could tell you in a stressed Somalia or Democratic Republic of Congo or Burma or these very, very stressed and vulnerable countries around the world, what needs to be done. Because the United Nations has made a lot of mistakes around the world, but they have also done a lot, and Mozambique actually is a great example of this, where after a civil war that devastated the country, the United Nations was able to help rebuild state institutions. You know, I think there's this sort of ultra-liberalism in this country sometimes that people apply both to our own country and to other countries where they downplay the importance of state institutions. Well, we saw during Hurricane Katrina that you have basic state institutions that you need to keep robust, not just in times of emergency, But for example, now with the mounting economic woes in this country, the social welfare safety net needs to be rebuilt. And the same thing is true all around the world. So that back in the sort of early 90s, there was this idea that non-governmental organizations could deliver all the services people needed around the world, and you didn't really need to bother about having a functioning government in a place like Burundi or Uganda. And so they poured a lot of money into the NGOs, and the governments proved incapable of delivering basic services in many cases. And of course, one of the most tragic examples of that is the occupation regime in Iraq, where the government was just dismantled by fiat in the de-Ba'athification process. And now it's been 5 years and they've been unable to reconstitute it, and it's incapable of delivering basic services to the people. So I think that kind of stresses that you need to have governments that deliver basic services, and that it need not be just the United States that decides which.
Ms. Cava, thank you for an excellent presentation, and I look forward to reading your book. My question has to do with the what I would call the raging controversy between Senators McCain and Obama concerning mediations with other countries, in particular adversaries. And it would be helpful if you could comment on your view concerning that.
Sure. There seems to be a sort of widespread view in this country that if you talk to somebody that you disagree with, that you've sold the shop. And therefore, they think that even talking to somebody that you disagree with is appeasement. It's not. Appeasement is when you give them a whole other country, like Sudetenland. I mean, that was the classic example, without getting anything in return. When you talk to other countries with whom you have even very serious disagreements, and remember that during the Cold War, the Soviets had thousands of nuclear missiles that were targeted right here, practically speaking, on Charlottesville, Virginia, but certainly on Washington, D.C., extremely capable, extremely potentially hostile, and locked into disagreements on so many issues around the world, but successive U.S. governments talked to them. And through the talking, we're able to ramp down the dangers through the arms control process, and finally to contribute to the transformation of the whole system inside Russia and the international system as well. That's called diplomacy. It's not called appeasement. Appeasement is when you give them the store. So, you know, regarding Iran or Syria or Hamas or Hezbollah, I have to say I've actually personally done quite a lot of interviewing with leaders in both those two countries and leaders of both Hamas and Hezbollah. They have very serious disagreements with us. That's not news. But they want to build a better relationship. And they want, for example, in Hamas, which is the current bête noire, because there are all these accusations that Hamas supports Barack Obama, which I think is ridiculous. Hamas did participate in an election in Palestine 2 years ago that was sponsored by the United States and that was certified by actually the Carter Center and other international monitoring bodies as a free and fair election, and they won it. And afterwards, the U.S. and Israel put on a terrible embargo and tried to crush and encircle Hamas. They have a really serious issue with us. We have really serious issues with them. You know, that is precisely what diplomacy is designed for. It doesn't mean that the president should travel to Iran tomorrow and start kissing and hugging President Ahmadinejad, or you know, do the same with the head of Hamas. It means that you can start discussions. You know, like Kissinger went to China on behalf of Nixon in the 1970s. You can start the discussions secretly, semi-secretly, at a low level, at a high level. But, you know, Winston Churchill, I guess, gets quite a lot of credit in this country for his staunch stand against Nazism in the Second World War. But one of his main dictums was, jaw, jaw is always better than war, war.
Ms. Cobbin, I have a vision of re-engagement, which is the reinstitution of the Peace Corps. And I was wondering if, in your overview of ordinary people around the world, if you think that's a practical approach early on after 2008?
Yes, I think it would be if other elements of the policy had been gotten right at the same time. I mean, I think there's a real problem for people seeking to send Peace Corps volunteers. Well, we won't even mention like downtown Gaza right now, but even to Tanzania or to many other countries around the world where people are horrified at the unilateralism and militarism of US policy as a whole, it's probably rather hard in many countries around the world to find safe and constructive places for large numbers of Peace Corps volunteers to go. But yes, definitely in the context of a switch of our resources for engagement in foreign affairs from purely military tools, which is what something like 85% of the budget goes to, the budget that affects foreign affairs, to peaceful means of engaging. That is a largely beefed up international diplomatic corps, one that is cut away from its current linkage to US military planning. Right now, if you want to find out about, you know, US relations in Somalia or many other countries throughout Africa, the big experts are the ones in the Defense Department, which has hundreds of people working on African issues. And they have, you know, they have this relationships with military leaders throughout the continent, which our diplomats just don't have. They don't have the resources, they don't have the numbers, they don't have the training. So, you know, we need to take resources massively from the military and put them into non-military means of engagement. And that will also help when it comes to making tough decisions. Because when there's a crisis, like they say, you know, if the only tool you have is a hammer, then every problem is going to look like a nail. We need to develop a whole toolbox.
Thank you so much for trying to find a balance in this kind of dire time. Your book title, Reengage, has to me a suggestion of individual action as well. And I'm wondering if you have any suggestions how we as individuals might find a way to reengage and encourage others to do the same.
Yeah, I'm glad you picked up on that. It does have an individual aspect to it. And, you know, one thing that I think this current election season gives us a lot of opportunities to do is not just in the political campaigns where we have seen, you know, unprecedented turnout, but also in reviving all the kind of grassroots organizations that, you know, the environmental organizations, the anti-nuclear organizations at the grassroots. Where are they? I mean, back in the 1980s, when I first came to this country, there were these massive movements against nuclear weapons. Now, all that we have, I shouldn't say all, but the most prominent thing that we see in terms of, you know, anti-nuclear activity is coming from some very interesting places. It's coming from Senator Sam Nunn and from Henry Kissinger and from others who really understand the issues at a very deep level because they have worked them as responsible officials for a long time, and they are calling for nuclear disarmament. But where are the people on the street? I don't know. You know, I think we need to get much more of that activism going through our congregations, through our civic organizations, to build that up along with, for example, the environmental movement. And there are some tough decisions to be made, of course, especially this whole thing about farm subsidies that I raised. You know, farm subsidies have been sold to the American people since the New Deal as a way of saving the small family farmer. If you actually go, and I've got a little graph in here that shows you where the farm subsidies go. And, you know, the bottom line there is that the you know, vast mass of the farm subsidies go to big agricultural corporations and to wealthy landowners who, you know, I think, who was it, Ted Koppel or somebody, you know, who's not lacking for a shilling or two. And you know, he owns some land that comes with U.S. federal farm subsidies. We really need to look at ways of reviving rural communities in this country in ways that do not involve making these handouts to big corporations and to the biofuel industry. So, you know, there's a lot of work to do in discussing these issues in localities and with our members of Congress. I guess Congress has just passed another great big farm subsidy bill, but we have to make sure that the next time they discuss it, they really look at the effects both in this country and overseas on those kind of subsidies. So yeah, individual engagement as well as national engagement.
This is sort of a follow-up to an earlier question, but just to look at a specific example, if you take the case of Cuba, which is a country that has undergone a succession to a new leader, but has not undergone open and free and fair elections, and has not made any kind of changes in terms of human rights, what kind of recommendations would you make to the new administration coming in next year on how to deal with this, a country of this sort?
Well, definitely I would say re-engaging with Cuba is a must. I mean, the country is clearly going through a lot of very interesting transitions on its own, and it's been harmed very, very badly. We need to recognize that by 40-plus years of U.S. sanctions. I saw a little video clip recently in which Brent Scowcroft was saying, you know, of course we should re-engage with Cuba. I'm hopeful that whichever new president we get, this will be part of the review of how America really stands with the world. And, you know, Cuba is important. Haiti is so important. I mean, for us as Americans, we have to think about the suffering there perhaps even more and get those kind of policies well organized. In a sense, if we can bring Cuba into the into the tent, I think, and Venezuela in a different way, that could really provide resources that Haiti really needs in terms of, you know, the Cuban expertise in primary health care. That's something that Haiti needs absolutely. You know, there are lots of ways that we could think of a regional kind of approach there that would involve Cuba, not in a way that, you know, overrides the rights of the Cuban people that are still important, but getting them involved in things in the region, I think, is a good way to start.
Yes, your article talking about the World Court and Milosevic and the trial that's gone on forever and it's kind of made him still a hero to certain people. You mentioned the situation in dealing with Uganda and then what happened in South Africa. Could you talk a little bit about, we have this giant court. What do we do here to make it work better or really resolve things?
Well, I guess this is an issue, this whole question of the International Criminal Court, where I have a lot of disagreements with my friends in the human rights movement in this country, because I don't actually think that it's a very important question for us as American human rights advocates to urge our country to sign on to the ICC. I see a lot of problems in the ICC. And this, in essence, it was part of the last book that I wrote. The bottom line is that I think the ICC perpetuates a very sort of accusatory and polarizing way of resolving conflicts, where what you need is ways to resolve those conflicts that are much more inclusive and forward-looking. South Africa is a great example. But I have sat in an internally displaced persons camp in Uganda with community leaders of that IDP camp. They'd been there for 10 years because of the conflict in northern Uganda between the government and the Acholi, the Lord's Resistance Army. And so they were just desperate to get back to their farms and their homesteads, which in many cases they could see outside of the IDP camp, but they were not allowed to return to them. And they couldn't return to them because the situation of war between the Lord's Resistance Army and the government was completely held up. I mean, the push to make peace between those two parties was completely held up by the machinations of the ICC. So, you know, you had lawyers in The Hague who, you know, get very nice salaries, let's face it, and sitting in The Hague is a very nice place to sit. There are beautiful restaurants, beautiful art galleries. You know, you can actually spend a lot of time there arguing your cases and get nicely paid and build up your pension rights. And meantime, these subsistence farmers, around 1 million of them in the north of Uganda, were trapped in their IDP camps and have been trapped for 2.5 years at this point, unable to return to their homes, living horrible lives. I talked to one man who had lost 6 of his 10 children. You know, so there's a real cost to doing this ICC business. I don't think the international community has got that right yet. And I think that for me as a human rights advocate in this country, I can see so many other issues that I think it's more important for us to fight for in this country regarding human rights. First and foremost, our own country's behavior in Guantanamo Bay, in Abu Ghraib, in all those secret prisons around the world in Afghanistan and elsewhere. You know, I think for American citizens to go around the world pointing fingers at other governments, it's quite appropriate for other governments or people in other countries to say, you should first look at the beam in your own eye before you talk about the little mite in my eye. So, you know, my priorities are a little different from many of my friends in the human rights movement, but I think we all agree that that stuff that has been happening in Guantanamo has to be brought to an end, and the violations of human rights norms and Geneva Conventions norms around the world. And, you know, that is a big part of what has harmed our country. It's not just that it's wrong in itself for us to do those bad things, waterboarding, torture, all those things. That is bad in itself, but it is also harmful to our country around the world. Because just like that little girl who was skipping down the road in Tanzania, and the only thing she knew about Americans is that we bomb people, maybe if I met another little girl skipping down the road today, she would say, oh, America, tell me about Guantanamo. I mean, you know, it is that big in the international consciousness as a part of what America is. So we have to stop it.
Hi, Elena. So early next year, we're going to have a new president. Imagine that an advisor to the president gets your book and reads it, and you get a call, and in the first 100 days, they want to start re-engaging with the world. What would be the single most important thing that you think we could do? Would it be changing our situation in Iraq, signing out of the Kyoto Protocol, paying our UN dues, closing Guantanamo? What do you think would be the most important first step?
Oh, boy, I think you just named about 4 of them, Sean. You did a great job there. I think you could do all of them. I mean, I think regarding Iraq, the new president should call in the permanent members of the Security Council, all the members of the Security Council, and say, we want the United Nations to convene the peace gathering that will enable us to withdraw from Iraq. I don't think the United States can convene that gathering. The United Nations has to convene it, because the United Nations can bring in Iran, Turkey, Syria, Jordan, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, all of them on an equal basis with the Iraqi government, and have that kind of regional discussion that will allow the US to withdraw. And then the UN can bring in all the Iraqi parties to figure out whether they want to continue with the present governance system or whether they want to change it and how. So, you know, I think that is maybe the first thing that you would do, but you could also announce a plan to close Guantanamo at the same time. I think the present administration looks very eager to close Guantanamo before they leave office. And I think we should encourage every step that they take in that direction, because the situation of those people who've been sitting there, I don't think most of them are currently being tortured, but I think most of them are being subjected to this intense sensory deprivation, like the super ultramax prisons in this country, but worse, where for 23 hours per day, they don't get to see anything, smell any flowers, smell any coffee. I mean, it's intense sensory deprivation, and that can drive a person crazy, and many of these people have been driven crazy. So we have to end that situation as soon as we can. Kyoto, actually, it's too late to get onto Kyoto, because Kyoto ends in 2012. So now there's an international negotiation for what comes after Kyoto. That's what we have to leap into with both feet and say, this time, we're going to be a part of it. So yeah, you brought up some great things, and I think they can all be done in the first 100 days.
A lot of the foreign policy issues revolve around international economics. And so the U.S. has often been sort of accused of putting in limitations and constraints, you know, when we engage in international economic issues. And China, I just read this book on China and Africa, is going into Africa for resources and saying, oh, we're not like the U.S., we just want your resources. Do you have any thoughts about China's approach to foreign policy?
Well, I do cover a little bit about China and the rise of China in the book. And of course, it's the big issue, in a sense, that once our next president has dealt with the questions of, you know, this quagmire, or as I call it, a sinkhole in Iraq, and once it's dealt with the Kyoto Treaty and coming into the Bali negotiations, and once it's done all those great things that I say it can and should do in the first 100 days, you need to have some long-range planning for how you really include China in the planning for the next 20, 30 years of life on this planet. So it's true that Chinese businessmen and officials go to many countries in the world and conclude all kinds of business deals without regard to human rights. But actually, so do many of our businessmen. So, you know, I don't think we can, and certainly in Britain, you know, the role of British Petroleum in the Niger Delta has just been horrible. So I don't think we can necessarily point fingers, but we can have a discussion. We can say, you know, as citizens and hopefully also as our government, once our government is, you know, really kind of responsive, we can say we have really serious concerns about your actions in Darfur, for example. But look again at Darfur as well. You know, the Chinese actually have peacekeepers there. We don't. I mean, the press in this country tends to love to get very accusatory against other countries, and this is one of my big concerns about the mainstream media here. But, you know, they don't look at the good things that other countries are doing. I think China, you know, has great relations with most of its neighbors there in Asia, and that is not just because, you know, they're interested in the Chinese market, which they are, but also because China has treated most of them with respect, doesn't come with the kind of historical baggage that Japan comes with, and is very well integrated into the region, largely through the networks of expatriate Chinese businessmen who are throughout the whole region. And that is happening increasingly in Africa and in some portions of Latin America. So we think that the United States has great soft power around the world because of Hollywood, and because, you know, people want Hollywood and they want Baywatch and all of this. Well, I would say a couple of things. First of all, I don't think the actual influence of, you know, watching Dallas on TV or Baywatch is a net plus for American for America's image around the world at a time when, you know, people are starving in Sierra Leone, in India, in other countries around the world, for them to see endless replays of Baywatch, and they think that all Americans live like that. They don't understand, you know, that we have our own problems in this country. But it's true, we are a wealthy country. I'm not sure that we would necessarily need to flaunt that. So soft power is a very interesting concept. And one of the fascinating things that I've worked with, because I've been writing this blog for 5 years now called Just World News, is, you know, that you can have these sort of horizontal relationships amongst the peoples of the world that are not mediated by the big media or by Hollywood or by governments anymore. We can start to have that with Chinese people to a certain extent. You know, so if you get the infrastructure into places like Africa or Bengal or Bolivia, you know, then all kinds of people can start having relationships amongst themselves on the internet. And I don't mean sexual relationships, I mean intellectual relationships. I mean, what we can read on the web from around the world today is just amazing. So that's what's going to transform things. Sorry, it's a little bit of a diversion from what you were talking about, but I think, you know, yes, we have concerns about many aspects of China's human rights policy, both internally and internationally. It's not a reason to go to war. It's a reason to have a conversation.
With thanks for this conversation, we welcome you back again after the new president comes into office, and we'll see how much of your good advice has been taken. Thank you very much. Thank you.